We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of a child's near-fatal accident and a mother's steadfast love and commitment as her son makes a long journey toward recovery. When Joan Ryan learned her 16-year-old adopted son had fallen off a skateboard, she went to check it out. She found no blood, no obvious injury. But soon she and her husband would learn the accident had been very serious. Ryan Tompkins had suffered a traumatic brain injury. As terrifying as the injury was, and as the struggles that lay ahead would demand much, they offered mother and son a second chance. Ryan had ups and downs in school and in social situations. He was diagnosed with a mild form of autism and ADHD. Joan loved her son, of course, with a fierceness, she says, that could make her cry just to look at him. But she could also be impatient with him, and for that, she felt terrible. Joan Ryan tells the story of mother and son finding their way to a new understanding of one another in the book The Water Giver, the story of a mother, a son, and their second chance. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455. Joan Ryan is an award-winning journalist and author. She was one of the first women sports columnists in the country. Joan, her husband Barry Tompkins, their son Ryan, and dog Bill call Marin County, California, home. The Water Giver is published by Simon & Schuster. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Joan Ryan, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm good, Celeste. Thank you for inviting me onto your show.
Oh, my pleasure. And how's Ryan?
Well, you know, there's no short answer to that. He started college in September, small college in New London, Connecticut, called Mitchell College, that has really great support. And we knew another family whose son had had a brain injury who went to Mitchell College and was, you know, fairly successful there. So Ryan was eager to go. And, you know, unfortunately, the deficits that he has became very clear, that he really couldn't manage his own life. Unfortunately, the brain injury left him with a seizure disorder for which he has to take medication 3 times a day, and he has to take other medication also for some other consequences of the brain injury, which we can certainly talk about. So one of the things is he has short-term memory problems, so he wasn't remembering to take his pills, and then, you know, as most college freshmen, he wasn't sleeping as much as he needs to. And when you have a brain injury, you need a lot of sleep. And, you know, he was probably drinking a little bit and whatnot. So the wheels just fell off. So about a month in, the dean of students called. So I went and picked him up, and, you know, we got him back on track. So now really what we're looking at is a next level of rehab, because when Ryan left the acute rehab facility, he was only 16, so of course he came home, whereas the other young adults who were with him in rehab went on to that next level of rehab where you learn to self-regulate, you learn to manage your own life. So we're looking at a couple of places that Ryan can get that kind of intensive therapies, training, 24/7 teachable moments.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
One of the things that came as a surprise to me is the crazy quilt of therapy that is out there, and you've got to, well, it's not even a quilt. You've got to do the stitching yourself.
You do. I mean, what's interesting about brain injury, and maybe most people, you know, have known about brain injury in the news the last few years because it's the signature injury of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. So the VA has really been on the vanguard of the newest technology in treatment. So the good news, of course, is that we save many more people with severe brain injuries. The downside is that the aftercare hasn't caught up with that. So we have a lot of people with brain injuries out there who don't have the therapies and the support and the management that's necessary. So once you're out of acute care, what we found was, boy, there's really nobody in charge. The neurosurgeon's job is, you know, well done. The neurologist, at least that we had, was not really a brain injury person. We had a separate pharmapsychiatrist for the meds, and we had, you know, the rehab doctor, you know, her job was done because you're not in rehab anymore. So it still is very frustrating to sort of figure out, well, what are we supposed to do? And I think a lot of people with brain injuries or who are caretakers of brain injured people are feeling like we all have to reinvent the wheel.
Mm. Let's go back to August 16th of 2006. What happened? That was the day of the accident.
Well, Ryan, who was 16 at the time and, you know, had a lot of learning disabilities, you know, very impulsive, ADHD. He had something called sensory integration disorder. And, you know, so things were, you know, always a bit of a struggle for him, but a happy kid, you know, lovely person. But he started to realize that, you know, he was very good with his hands, so he was making skateboards. And so one day, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he was putting new bearings on his wheels of his skateboard and wanted to try them out. And he had loaned his helmet to the kid next door, so instead of taking the 2 seconds it would take to go get the helmet, you know, he wants to go try his bearings. So long story short, 3 kids knock on our back door. Ryan fell off his skateboard. You know, there's an ambulance. I go 2 blocks. You know, Ryan has fallen off, but he's still conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And he's strapped into a stretcher, and he said his head hurts, but, you know, we're not thinking anything because Ryan's a big, strong kid and, you know, really has never been hurt and hardly ever been sick. So we go to the emergency room, and, you know, the ambulance takes him. My husband and I go, and we're waiting and we're waiting and we're waiting. And, you know, even the receptionist says, I don't know why you can't be back there because, you know, as most of us who have kids, and if you've ever been in the emergency room before, you're usually back there in those curtained rooms with them. And so, you know, we waited probably about 45 minutes, and then those double doors, those automatic double doors open, and, you know, out comes a middle-aged woman who says, are you Ryan Tompkins' parents? We said, yes. And I look on her name tag, and it says Chaplain. And we couldn't figure mm-hmm. out how a fall off a skateboard, you know, warranted a chaplain. And, of course, we soon found out that he had suffered a traumatic brain injury. And by the time we saw him, which was, you know, only a few minutes later, he was already in a drug-induced coma and thus started 3 months of hospitalization and rehab.
Yeah. He wasn't wearing his helmet, and you joked with a police officer on the scene, as soon as he's fixed up, I'm going to kill him.
Right, right. And the officer, who we knew well, because we live in this very small town in Northern California, Officer Bob said, well, not if I get to him first.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were joking, so clearly, you know, we had no clue that this was as serious. And the EMTs didn't either. It wasn't until he was in the ambulance on the way to the hospital that he spiraled out and showed all the symptoms of a traumatic brain injury.
Had he been wearing a helmet, what would have been the situation?
We don't know. I mean, it certainly wouldn't have been as severe as it was because part of what happened, we found out later from the kids who were there, was that, you know, he fell directly on his head, sort of the right front of his head, and then he was going down a hill. And then as he rolled down the hill, he kept hitting his head. So if he had his helmet on, I don't think he would have had all those secondary injuries. And certainly the helmet would have absorbed at least some of the blow from the first fall.
Mm. How soon was he in the operating room?
Oh, I would say it was with about an hour and a half because they had to wait for the neurosurgeon to come to look at the CT scan. And as soon as the neurosurgeon saw the CT scan, there was an obvious bleed, and he went right in and evacuated the bleed. And that really wasn't eventually the problem. It was the swelling. And what happens, I mean, even if you're punched in the face, right, you know, you swell, and it's about 72 hours, you can expect the swelling. And, of course, if you're punched in the face, your skin is elastic enough to accommodate the swelling. Well, obviously, your skull isn't elastic.
Mm-hmm.
So if your brain continues to swell, it gets very tight in there, and you can close down the blood vessels or push down on the brain stem and stroke out, basically. So they were, Ryan's brain, after 72 hours, just continued to swell and swell and swell and swell. So eventually they ended up having to take the measure of removing the top of his skull to allow the brain to swell up and out, and that's what saved his life. And what's interesting is they keep the skull off for like 5 weeks. And for Ryan, they stored it in a tissue bank, a refrigerated tissue bank, but oftentimes some neurosurgeons store it in the abdomen. Number one, so you don't lose it, really, because sometimes that can happen. And number two, that it doesn't get infected.
Well, how were you and your husband coping with this at the time, all this rush of information, and here's your big, strong 16-year-old son, 6'3", you know, so down and out.
You know what's interesting, and you never know how you're going to react when something like that happens, and I think part, just to give a little background, I mean, my husband and I have been through a lot with Ryan, and he and I approached child rearing in very different ways, and I was the law and order kind of mom, and he was the guy who, you know, gave him cookies behind my back, you know. And he always saw what was great about Ryan, and I always saw what needed fixing.
Mm.
And, you know, we ended up, you know, a few years ago going to marriage counseling for this. I think when you have a very, very challenging child, it really, you know, obviously puts a strain on a marriage. And it was all we seemed to talk about, and we completely disagreed. I just thought he needed more discipline and more boundaries and, you know, more experts. And, you know, Barry was more like, oh, you know, he's okay, it's not that bad, you know. So we went to marriage counseling and really discovered a lot about why our parenting styles are the way they are. So I highly recommend it for anybody out there who's dealing with this, because you do get to this impasse and you really can't move on without that third party helping you to do that. So when this crisis happened, Barry and I were very much on the same page. Neither one of us are drama queens, and we were able, without any effort, to just really live in the moment, and literally the moment, like, okay, what's going on this hour? Let's just deal with this hour, and now let's deal with this hour, and then it became, okay, this day we can deal with. We very much lived in the moment. Were we in denial? Absolutely. I'm sure we were in denial because, you know, our friends later on, you know, would be nodding their head. You know, they, in the moment, they'd be nodding, oh, yeah, he's going to be fine, you know. And then, you know, when they left, they're like, oh, my God, this is horrible, you know. At one point, two of my closest friends told me much later that they were planning Ryan's funeral for me because he had gotten to the point where, you know, really nobody thought he was going to survive. And Barry and I were almost unfailingly cheerful, you know, because we really believed so intensely in Ryan. And I remember the doctor who we loved, this neurosurgeon, who taught us how to read CT scans and all the rest of it. He said, I can't believe, you know, you two are just, you know, always so up. And I said, well, you're at such a disadvantage. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you don't know Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. And I said, you know, your job is to worry about all the stuff that could happen. Our job is to believe in our son. And that's what we did. Not that there weren't moments where I broke down and, you know, there was one moment where I did think he was going to die and, you know, it was devastating, absolutely devastating. But most of the time we just were like, okay, you know, let's just keep putting one foot in front of the other.
In a period like this, in a period of life like this, though, you know, when is it denial and when is it faith?
That's a good question. I don't know. And are they the same thing? And I had, you know, I'm a completely lapsed Catholic and really have been grappling with faith in the traditional religious sense. You know, do I believe in God? What do I believe? What is prayer? All of that. And when you go through something like this, you know, obviously you have to revisit everything you believe. And so I had faith. I discovered faith, but it was faith in Ryan. I don't know that it was faith in God and in, you know, my Catholic upbringing, God. I also really felt for the first time in my life, you know, some people, my parents call it prayer, some people call it energy, I don't know what it is, but boy, did we feel surrounded by it when we were sitting in that ICU waiting room. I mean, it was almost like you could watch this stream of good thoughts and good energy, you know, come up the elevator and come up and surround us and surround Ryan. I mean, it was so palpable. So, again, I don't know what to name it, but I felt it.
I have a cousin who has battled cancer over and over again, and that has been so important to her. And we've all been together on Caring Bridge.
Yes. That's where we were, too. I kept a blog. That was the basis for the book. I mean, really, the foundation of the book were all my blog entries on caringbridge.org.
Yeah. It was a way for all of us to stay connected. And it was a way when Kathy was well enough that she could participate in our wishes and our stories and what we were doing and keeping her up to date.
It's so important, and you know, when Barry and I would come home at night, and I didn't sleep at the hospital, I didn't do some of the things that, you know, other parents would say, God, how could you have gone home? But, you know, one thing the very first ICU doctor told us, he said, look, you are in for a long, long journey here. And he said, you have to picture yourself that you are a ship on an ocean. Sometimes it's going to be smooth sailing. Sometimes you're going to hit squalls. You have to keep your ship strong because you're not going to do your child any good if you become sick. He said, I've seen too many parents become sick themselves, and then they can't even go into the ICU. He said, get sleep, eat, take walks. So we did that. And so when I would come home at night, the first thing I did was open my laptop, write my post, and then read all the messages from the day. And that I went to sleep with all those messages in my head, and it was wonderful.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Joan Ryan. She is the author of The Water Giver, the story of a mother, a son, and their second chance. This is a story of traumatic brain injury. It's also the story of a second chance for mother and son to really have a better understanding of who they are. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. One of the stories in the book that you tell early that gave me a real sense of Ryan being a really wonderful person is when he's a little boy, all of 4 years old, and you had some amazing bedtime conversations with him. You'd talk about God and aging and heaven.
Yeah, it is interesting because Ryan and I did have a very complicated and difficult relationship. You know, I looked at him and saw what needed fixing, and my husband looked at him and just saw what was wonderful about him. And, you know, over the years, I found myself, without realizing it, becoming more his relentless reformer than his loving mother. I was judgmental. I was, in retrospect, I was having my motherhood was more about me than it was about him. I kind of had this snow globe vision of what my life was going to be like as a mother and raising this child, and he would love to read, and he would be this way and that way, and I wanted to have all of these, you know, little league experiences, and all the rest of it. Well, that's not the child I got, you know. So I was trying to fit him. You know, I was raising the child I wanted him to be rather than the child I had. And so during the day, and he was a tough kid, I must say, and the one thing I want to say to parents out there who have challenging children with learning disabilities or behavior disorders or whatever, it is tough, and don't let anybody tell you it's not tough. Mm-hmm. And so there were times where it was not pretty in my house, and I was very judgmental of my child and didn't feel real good about it. And before I really embraced the fact that he had some, you know, neurological and cognitive things going on, I mean, I just thought, oh, my God, this kid just doesn't listen. You know, I'm a loser as a mom. Why can't everybody else figure it out? I can't figure this out. You know, so I'd be beating up on him and beating up on myself even more. But at night, every single night, we would sit in bed, you know, just the two of us under the covers, and I'd read to him, and we'd have our talks, and it was just this sacred, wonderful time because we did love each other immensely. And there were times where we would sit there, and Ryan would say, and I don't know what page it's on, it's probably...
Page 16.
Page 16, oh yeah, let me just read a little bit. Sometimes Ryan mused about God when he was 4 years old. He wondered aloud if only God was real and we were just his dream. He once told me that inside each person are boxes inside boxes, hundreds of thousands of them. You could open one each day until you were 20, then one each year. At the center, he said, is perfection. And some people get so far as to cut the tape off the final box. He informed me that I had 103 more boxes. I said I'd be dead before I got to the perfect one. He said I'd open it in heaven with God.
Mm. What a sweet boy.
He is. I mean, and that was the thing that was heartbreaking to me. I'd say, why can't I respond to him just with love and compassion? Why am I so angry all the time at him? And one of the things I learned really from going to counseling with my husband is that I was raised, there were six of us in my family, and the brother that was a year older than I was, Bobby, had, you know, really, really significant problems, behavioral, cognitive, physical, and he was teased and just, he lived this awful childhood and was lonely, never had any friends, very negative, irritable person, very difficult to be around. And I realized that I feared Ryan was going to be Bobby. And so my fear was coming out in anger. And once I realized that, I did start to change how I looked at Ryan and said, Ryan's not Bobby. You know, Ryan's Ryan. Mm-hmm. Ryan has incredible strengths. And slowly I started to change, but I really didn't change, unfortunately, until the accident. And I thought I was going to lose him.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting to talk with you on a cell phone on line one. Hi. Is the caller there? Maybe they'll call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The numbers to call if you'd like to talk with our guest this afternoon, Joan Ryan, author of The Water Giver, The Story of a Mother, a Son, and Their Second Chance. Later in the book, as we're walking with you and your husband and Ryan coming out of the coma, this goes also to his personality.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote on an erasable board in the hospital, I love you, Mom, but you are a pain in the butt.
Right. And it was so funny because, well, I was using the erasable board just to see if he could form his letter. So I wrote, I love you, and then to see if he could write it. So he did. It's like, oh, that's great. And then he continued to write. And then he wrote, but you are a pain in the butt. And I was so thrilled because, of course, he wrote, he spelled both butts correctly. I was like, yes, number one, his humor is in there, and number two, his brain is functioning, because, you know, what they tell you after a severe brain injury is you don't know what person will emerge from that. You don't know how much their brain has been impacted and what parts of their brain have been impacted. So when we saw that, before he could speak, and he actually couldn't even move any of the muscles in his face, so we couldn't discern mood or pain or happy, you know, you couldn't discern anything. So when he was able to write even a little bit, we're like, okay, it's Ryan, he's in there.
And you describe yourself as being like a new mother.
I was. It was interesting because there was a, you know, certainly Ryan was like a baby again. He couldn't speak. He couldn't walk. He couldn't swallow. He was paralyzed on the left side because he had a right side brain injury, and that all eventually came back. He was wearing diapers, and he was, you know, sort of reaching out the way babies do at a mobile, you know, that he's just rediscovering the world in a lot of ways. And all he wanted, just like a baby, was just to be cuddled and stroked, and he had to kiss everybody. And he's not a kisser. He was always a hugger, never a kisser. He had to kiss everybody who came in the room. And sometimes he would just pull me down to him in the bed and just have his arms around me. And I would stay there until he fell asleep. And so he was so much like a baby and sort of looking up at me with those, you know, great eyes that babies do. So I truly got, in a very literal sense, a second chance at being his mother. And this time, without being conscious of it, I just was different. You know, I wasn't referring to the books and going online and trying to figure it out and doing the paint-by-numbers motherhood. I was just being his mother and wholly and completely just his mother.
Yeah. I think your book also offers us some insights into being a mother with an adopted child.
Mm-hmm.
That fear, especially at first, I imagine, is quite acute, that while you're holding this child in your arms, will you really be able to keep him?
In what way?
In that, will the biological parents want, because you write about, you know, you were really cautious, mm-hmm, with being prepared in terms of baby clothes and,
right,
and the decorating the room. I thought that was an interesting,
yeah,
insight into the
right,
the issues that people who adopt deal with.
Right, and in California, at that time, it's now, I think, a lesser time, but at that time, 19 years ago, there was a 6-month period where the birth mother could change her mind. And in Ryan's case, there was a birth mother and birth father who were together, unmarried, but the birth mother had lost her, she was an only child who had lost her mother and her father within a year of Ryan's birth. So even though we knew intellectually she had made this choice to give up her baby for adoption, we thought when push came to shove and she was holding her flesh and blood in her arms, how would she possibly absorb another loss? So when we got the call that she was in labor, we went down to Hemet, California, where she was delivering, which is near Palm Springs. We went down, but as you said, you know, we just had the barest of baby equipment in our home in case we came home empty-handed. And, you know, this woman was just an extraordinary woman who, you know, we were still in touch with. And last year when Ryan turned 18, met them. Ryan had a really great experience because 8 years after he was born, they married. His birth parents married, had 2 more children, live in Hawaii, which is Ryan's favorite place in the whole world. And so last summer we went over there and, you know, they welcomed him like their long-lost son and invited all the members of the family from all the islands in Hawaii and had this huge party for him. And we were always of the belief as adoptive parents that you can never have too many people who love you. So we never looked at his biological parents as threats to us. We just said, hey, you know what? Your tribe can't be too big. And so he has this wonderful family in Hawaii, and he has my family. I have this huge family in Florida, and he has us and our makeshift family here of our incredible friends. So he's a pretty lucky kid.
Yeah. What's his outlook on life? How would you describe it?
You know, I think he's a very optimistic person. I think he's a lot like my husband in that way. He's a very warm person. He has, luckily, he's one of those kids that always has been passionate about a single thing, and it's cars and antiques. So what he wants to do with his life is restore vintage cars, and he's always wanted to do that. So I think if you have a passion in life, you're always going to be okay. And that's the one thing we told him about school. You know, school rewards generalists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as a journalist, I'm the ultimate generalist. You know, I can find something interesting, you know, I'm sure you are. But in school rewards that. You know, schools were invented for somebody like me. For him, you know, he's a specialist. I said, you know, the adult world rewards specialists. You only have to be good at one thing and really love it, and you're going to be fine.
You're set.
So our goal was just to get him through school without it just beating, you know, the stuffing out of him, and hopefully that has happened.
Let's take a call now. A listener in Philo on line one. Hi.
Hi. I came in sort of in the middle, but I definitely want to read this book. I was struck, well, just most recently by when you said being a generalist versus having a passion in life, just one specialty. My children were adopted. I guess the hardest thing for me is that I come from a very ambitious family, and just luckily we were all good generalists and got our college degrees. And people are just, even the best-meaning people, have this sort of bias against adopted kids, well, they're not quite as, mine are not, you know, as academically bright as their cousins. It's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard because there's always that comparison and I guess that a little bit of grieving that what if, you know, what if, and when you said accepting the child for what he is rather than for what your idea, you know, of what you wanted him to be, whatever, a big sports star or a big academic achievement. But I still run into sort of this bias against adopted, like people curious to say, well, were their parents on drugs? That there must have been something really wrong with them, to be adopted rather than to have your own.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that the challenge for me was to not get drawn into that because you're right. I mean, you can be surrounded by people, and we didn't find it so much the bias against adoption, but the bias against a kid who just didn't fit the mold.
Yeah.
You know, and we live in a fairly, you know, highly type A people. Everybody's doctors and lawyers, and my kid wasn't going to be a doctor and lawyer. You know, he wasn't going to Dartmouth. He wasn't going to Cal or Stanford. Right, and so what I
it's just
learned,
a little, yeah, it's harder to listen to. I say, I'm sorry, but go ahead because you were about to say something.
Well, you know, I learned that I needed to surround myself with people who really saw what was wonderful about my son.
Yeah,
didn't judge my son because God knows I was judging him enough myself and judging myself enough, but I didn't need that negativity from other people, and we really just cut a lot of people out of our lives who just, and even in my own family, it took a while for them to really see what was great about Ryan. They just saw this kid who seemed undisciplined, and all that kid needs is a good whack, and so, you know, I limited my visits, and now they're like, you know, Ryan's biggest fans, but at the time, it's survival instinct, right?
Mark, you could just, if you just got him into a good tutoring program, and and we've spent, you know, like, yes, we've done that for the last 15 years. We know that. You know, you're not telling us something we don't know. But I think maybe that is the trick, to not surround yourself with people who are concerned because is their kid going to get into Dartmouth or you know, or they're now, he's at the age where his a lot of his friends are, you know, some of them even like going around the country to see what school they want to go to. And I'm thinking, and the parents kind of complaining that, oh, we can't afford this. And I'm thinking, get down on your knees and be grateful.
Right.
You know,
right.
That you have such a hard decision to make that you don't know where to send your kid to college.
Right.
You know, and mine is not, you know, really very disabled. You know, there's always somebody worse off. But maybe it's just not surrounding yourself with
right, it's not. And also knowing that your values are different. You know what I want for my child? I want my child to be able to get up in the morning every day and go do something that makes them happy.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you know,
great.
And that's the wonderful thing. And if other people have different values, well, you know, that's kind of sad for them.
Yeah,
that they're measuring their child on the number of degrees and their GPA and all the rest of it. Would I have been that way had I had a different child? Oh, my God, maybe. You know, I have the tiniest bit of control issues and expectations. So, you know, I'm not too quick to judge them because, you know, I might have been sucked right into that myself.
Yeah.
But I'm not there, and I'm here. And so, you know, I just have a different set of values now as you do.
Well, thank you so much. I will go ahead and get your book.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Our guest, Joan Ryan, author of The Water Giver, the story of a mother, a son, and their second chance. Her son, Ryan Tompkins, suffered a traumatic brain injury as the result of falling off a skateboard. As terrifying as that was, the struggles that lay ahead would demand much. They offered both mother and son a second chance. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon, if you'd like, with a telephone call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the very moving moments in your book, Joan, is when Ryan calls you the water giver. Would you read the story from the book for us?
Sure. What page is that?
Page 147.
147. All right. All right. Where should I start? The next day, so this is when Ryan's out of ICU and he's in the step-down room, but he still can't have water because he can't swallow. The brain is not sending the signals down to make it go down through his esophagus. Instead, it's going down his trachea, and if he drinks water, he can get pneumonia. So, of course, all he wants is water, as anybody would, and he still can't really speak very well yet. The next day, Barry and I were hanging in his room before dinner. I was making a to-do list. My game phase had begun to return. There was work to be done now that Ryan was heading into the rehab phase. I added to my list 3-ring binders, brain injury research, books. All the day's visitors had gone home. Ryan noticed that someone had left a bottle of water on the windowsill. He asked for it by pouring an imaginary drink into his mouth. "Ryan, you know you can't have water yet," I said, forever the enforcer, the follower of the rules. He could get pneumonia if the water went into his lungs. Ryan slapped the mattress. "It's for your own good, sweetie," I said, the standard response to anything unpleasant I had required Ryan to do during the past 16 years. It had been a polite way of saying, "Buck up. This is the way it is. Get over it." Barry gave Ryan a green sponge on a stick. After about 4 of them, Ryan pointed to the bottle on the windowsill. "Real water," he whispered, his eyes locked on mine. I'm not sure why I did what I did next. I didn't think about it. There was no conscious decision, no internal debate. I rose from my chair, walked to the windowsill, and picked up the bottle. I filled the bottle's tiny cap about halfway, maybe a teaspoon's worth. I told Ryan to sit up straight and to tuck his chin as he swallowed, the way the speech therapist had been teaching him. I emptied the cap into his mouth. He tucked and swallowed. "More," he said. I poured water from the cap 3 more times. Barry shot me a look. I ignored him. Ryan was swallowing well, and he coughed only once and very gently. 30 minutes later, he leaned over the railing of the bed and spit the water back up. That night, Ryan fell asleep on his side, curled up with a deflating SpongeBob balloon between his knees. I had stayed at the hospital because Ryan had not been sleeping well. When he awoke at 10:30, a nurse had just come in. She was on the other side of the bed from me, unfurling a cuff to take his blood pressure. Ryan asked her for water. She launched into the spiel he heard every time he asked. The speech therapist hadn't approved it yet. He could get pneumonia. She would give him a damp sponge on a stick. Ryan turned and looked up at me the way he did as a baby in his crib, his eyes big and soft, taking me in as if I were an amazing dream, a miracle come true right in his room. "Mom," he sighed, "the water giver." I felt tears on my face before I fully comprehended what he said. I suddenly saw what he saw at that moment, a nurturer, a soother, a comforter. I was the mother he had been waiting for, the one who finally found her way to him, the water giver. I let the words wash over me. They felt like absolution.
Thank you for reading that. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest, Joan Ryan, reading there from her book, The Water Giver, the story of a mother, a son, and their second chance. So what's in store for the holidays for you folks?
Well, we're around and we're sort of waiting to see, we're waiting to see if the insurance approves him going to this next level of rehab. And I think the one we're hoping to go to is called the Center for Neuroskills in Bakersfield. So if the insurance does come through, and we should hear in the next week, Ryan could start as early as December and would come home for, 4 days over the holidays, and then hopefully enroll in community college down in Bakersfield. And then, once he comes home, I think he'll continue with community college, because one of the community college right here in our county has one of the best automotive programs in the state. So that could work out really well for him. Or after he's finished with this level of rehab, which could be 2 to 6 months, he may feel like he wants to go back to Mitchell College. They said the door's absolutely open for him, and so it'll be up to him. If he wants the academic business, he wants to major in business so he could run his own restoration garage someday, or if he wants to just concentrate right now on the skills in that. So it'll be up to him.
There will be poppy seed muffins.
There will be poppy seed muffins, and every Christmas there's always the poppy seed muffins, and it was so sweet. I was invited to a reading for a group of parents who have learning disabled children or special ed kids, and they had poppy seed muffins, the refreshment, and they packaged them up to send them home to Ryan. He was very happy. I just thought that was so thoughtful, because you write these things and you're like, oh my gosh, somebody noticed. So thank you for noticing that.
You're very welcome. And at the end of the book, Ryan puts in his 2 cents. How, you want to just give us a sense of that and his reaction to what you've done here in this book?
Well, I think Ryan's biggest reaction, and he hasn't read the book. I read a lot of it to him, mostly the beginning parts where I talk about raising him and the, challenges, which of course was, not quite news to him. This is something we've talked about a lot and, our struggles together. I think what he was struck by most in the aftermath of all of this was just the outpouring of support, how loved he is. And I don't know that he knew that, how many people love him and how many people admired how he went through rehab, because he just, I stood back in awe, truly, watching him, because there was just such humor and courage and perseverance and poise, and I just said, boy, I wouldn't be that way. So his afterword is a very hopeful one, a very grateful one. And he pokes fun at me and saying that, he does recognize that I have changed and I'm a different kind of mother, and that, I was a good mother beforehand, but as he so succinctly put it, pain in the butt. And he acknowledges that he was a pain in the butt, too.
Yeah.
And in my afterword, I end with, what I realize is, and do you mind if I just read the last paragraph?
Yeah, please do.
It's you know, how do you figure out what the right thing to do is? And this applies to before and after. You know, how do you raise a child with challenges, and how do you deal with, you know, navigating the brain injury? You know, how do we figure out the right thing to do? We can't. We make the smartest decisions we can each day based on the best information we have. What we can do is love him and love him and love him. For all we have been through, there is so little I know for certain, except maybe this. Motherhood is about raising and celebrating the child you have, not the child you thought you would have. It's about understanding that he is exactly the person he is supposed to be, and that if you're lucky, he just might be the teacher who turns you into the person you are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that. I mean, I am a much different, better, deeper person for having Ryan as my son.
There, we'll leave it. Joan, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Oh, Celeste, thank you so much for having me on.
Joan Ryan is an award-winning journalist and author. She's also a mom and a wife. She is the author, most recently, of The Water Giver, the story of a mother, a son, and their second chance. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. By the way, Joan Ryan was one of the first women sports columnists in the country, and her book, Little Girls in Pretty Boxes, The Making and Breaking of Elite Gymnasts and Figure Skaters, was named one of the top 100 sports books of all time by Sports Illustrated. Joan, her husband Barry Tompkins, and their son Ryan, and dog Bill call Marin County, California home. The Water Giver, again published by Simon & Schuster.